There was once a physician who had 4 unhealthy patients, and to each of them he gave the following prescription: eat well, exercise, reduce stress, and find like-minded companions that, in taking action upon these things, you will feel better, live longer, be happier, and much more. The first patient did not follow the physician's recommendation and, thus, made no improvements to his health. The second patient understood well what she had been prescribed and the reasons behind it, yet that head knowledge never made its way to her heart. While she knew what she ought to be doing, she did not do it, and like the first patient, she made no improvements to her health. For the third patient, the reasoning behind the physician's prescription flew right over her head, though not knowing why exactly, she nevertheless followed the regimen that was outlined for her and crafted a very healthy lifestyle and reaped its many benefits. She made much progress. However, because she couldn't speak to why she did what she did, her growth was limited, as was her ability to teach others. Finally, the fourth patient understood what he should be doing, why he should be doing it, and he did it. He improved his health, became a champion of healthy living who encouraged others to do likewise, and at next year's physical, he received a stellar report. Now let's apply this parable to Christians. Good morrow, everybody. My name is Ben LeBoot, and welcome to Stories of Symmetry, revealing beauty and purpose through another look at faith, the sacred, and the stories that unite us all. The parable of the four patients is a small attempt to jumpstart our conversation today, which, as it happens, is all about work. Not one's job, but one's deeds and actions. Each of the four patients was given the goal of improving his or her health, and each was also told how to reliably accomplish that goal, namely, through healthy eating, exercise, etc. The first patient did not do what he was told. The second knew what to do and why, but simply didn't bring herself to actually do it. The third patient did not know why she was changing her behavior, but she did, and she improved her health. Finally, the fourth patient knew what to do, why to do it, and he did it. Now, consider again the four patients. If each one were to tell you that he or she lived a healthy lifestyle, who would be telling the truth? Obviously, patient one could not. Patient 4 obviously could. For patient 3, ostensibly, yes, though she'd be better if she understood the reason behind her behaviors. As for patient 2, she is the most interesting. She knows all about what the physician prescribed, and all day long she can talk about healthy living. She knows all the right foods, all the stretches, all the exercises. No jargon is lost on her. And yet, when you look at her life, it is certainly not healthy, because she doesn't actually practice any of those healthy things. She therefore could not, in good faith, claim to be living a healthy lifestyle, just as we, in reasonable fairness, could not believe her if she were to make that claim. As it stands, patient 2 is the most interesting to us because she is, my friends, so exceedingly abundant in the church today. Now, I can't speak to physical health, and that's not our topic for discussion. Rather, we are discussing works, actions, and the reasons behind them. In this generation of the church, among some, not all, but many, congregations, actions and deeds are nearly taboo subjects, underemphasized at best, vilified at worst. And we need to ask ourselves why that is and what result it has. Many, if not most, or nearly all, of the world's religions are built around the idea of what its followers must do. If the religion claims that people are at odds with God, then it provides the things that people must do to reconcile themselves. Take, for example, Islam, with its five pillars of faith and belief that on Judgment Day, people's good actions will be weighed against their bad. If you've lived by the five pillars and your good deeds outweigh your bad, then you will be justified. Other faiths have similar notions, like karma. Ancient Judaism has what can be boiled down to a list of do's and don'ts, with an elaborate system of worship and sacrifices to provide atonement for trespasses or breaches of that list. Christianity, in its pure form, is distinctly unique among major religions because it does not provide any list of works that must be accomplished for people to right their wrongs with God. To understand why, we must begin with a fundamental starting point of Christianity, which is a person's sincere recognition that he or she is not right with God, and in fact has wronged God. And with that person being a mere human, and God being God, what could possibly be offered to God as reparation? The answer is nothing. There is no thing that you or I have or can do that could outweigh violating the will of our holy God. But before we despair that all is lost and doomed forever, enter the good news of Jesus. Followers of Christ believe that our debt has been paid, our fines defrayed, our prison sentence, rather our death sentence, already served. But how and who would do that for us? As it turns out, Jesus himself took the punishment that should have been ours. And because, in addition to being human, he himself was also God, his life was valuable enough to pay for the violation of God's law. You see, violation of holy and perfect commands require a holy and perfect requital. We are not holy and perfect, so our lives don't make the appropriate return. But Jesus, who was God, was holy and perfect, and so he was able to make the return that was necessary. But I suppose that the question now becomes, what do we owe Jesus? It's like he paid off our mortgage and saved us from the collectors. But now what are the terms of his loan? And Jesus says, nothing. It is a gift. Take a moment to consider that. We were on death row, but Jesus came and substituted his life for ours. We walked free while he died. And when we asked him what we owe, he said, nothing, it is a gift, you just have to accept it. There are no future payments, no fine print, no gotchas. The debt really has been paid, and the gift is ours to accept. And this good news presents us with three questions. Why would Jesus do that? How do we know it worked? And how do we unwrap the gift? So, first question, why would Jesus pay the punishment that we owed? Why on earth take our guilt upon himself, knowing that our lot was death? Jesus, in fact, answered that question many times throughout the Bible. In John 10, he told his followers, I am the good shepherd, and the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. And another time, greater love hath no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. So that's the reason, because he is good and loves us. We ask, why? God says, love. As to the second question about how it worked, that, my friends, is the resurrection. Jesus died in our place, but then he rose to life again to prove that his claims were true, and that God had accepted his offering. His death was like mailing a payment, but the resurrection was like receiving the notice that says all debts paid. It is our confirmation and his vindication. Now, before coming to the third question about how we can receive the gift, let me recap. And what I'm telling you, this, my friends, is the gospel. The gospel is not four books in the Bible. It is the good news of God. The word comes from the Greek euangelion, eu, as the prefix for good, and angelos, which means news or message, like an angel, literally a messenger or bringer of news. and euangelion becomes gospel, from the Old English good spell, meaning good message. So here, now, euangelion, the good news, the gospel of Jesus. We have done things that go against the perfect holiness of God. Therefore, because we sinned against the infinite goodness of the God of creation, we committed a crime whose punishment was death. But instead of us having to pay that death, Jesus, who was and is God, died in our place. Then he rose from the dead to prove to us that it worked. We don't owe Jesus anything for it. He died in our place as a free gift. And now, this is question 3, and now all we have to do to unwrap that gift is accept it. How does that work? It's deceptively simple, but I promise you that it works. Just accept it. Believe in your heart and say, Jesus, I acknowledge what you did for me, and I accept it. Traditionally, one's inner acceptance is demonstrated by an outward expression, like saying out loud a verbal confession of Jesus is Lord, or receiving baptism in water as a symbol of rebirth. But throughout the vast panoply of Christian denominations, that's about it. Just accept. And you might note, however, that there is something conspicuously absent. Works. Works, deeds, acts, facta, things to do, whatever you want to call it. Where do those come in? One of the most famous lines of the entire Bible is Ephesians chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. It says, "By grace you have been saved, through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, so that no one can boast." By grace. That is, by God's favor upon us, God's being gracious to us. By grace we have been saved, saved from our punishment, spared from death, been restored from a life far from God to one in which we can get as close to the Holy One as we desire. And it is by grace we have been saved through faith. That is, through our faith that it is as described, faith that Jesus did it. And this is not from yourselves. It wasn't us, it was Jesus. It is the gift of God, so that no one can boast. I can't act like I did anything for the salvation. I have nothing to brag about. Jesus did the work, and therefore he is the only one who can boast. Thus it is that, by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is the gift of God, so that no one can boast. So now, the point I've been driving home is that our salvation is gained without works on our part. There are no prerequisites or anything else that we need to bring to the table. As it said, Jesus meets us where we are. Take this truth and own it. Take it to heart. My friends, two things can be true at once. It is true that our salvation is not incumbent upon our works. But it is also true that every believer in Jesus does something. That every Christian has works. Do you need works to be saved? No. But are you saved if, after accepting Christ, you have no works? Are you a healthy patient if, cognitively, you understand a healthy lifestyle, but in practice you live out none of it? Can you reasonably call yourself a follower of Jesus if, somewhere in your brain, you have knowledge of the Bible, yet, in the way you live your life, you do not follow Jesus? The answer to all these is no. This truth, which is a difficult pill to swallow, no doubt, is positively avoided in our generation, and that's not good. The church has done a fine job of emphasizing the point that we are saved by grace, and that's true, but people need to be told that Jesus saves them as they are. We don't need to bring anything to the table. We don't need to clean up our act first. And it is also true that neither I nor anyone but God alone can determine the state of another's heart and speak to the state of their salvation. So no, neither I nor anyone can look at you and say whether or not you've become a true follower of Christ. And yet, as harsh as it sounds, faith without works is dead. And that's not my own opinion. It is what the Apostle James tells us. And that viewpoint is shared by all the New Testament characters. The entire book of James makes the point, but here's an excerpt from chapter 2. What good is it, friends, when someone says that he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him? If some person is naked or hungry, and you say to him, "Peace be with you, I hope that God warms you and fills your belly," and yet you don't give that person clothes and food, the things that the body needs, what good is it? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But one of you will say to me, "Some have faith, and others have works." Yet how can you show me your faith without works? I will show you my faith by my works. Or you believe that there is one God, good on you. But even the demons believe that, and yet they tremble. Do you want me to say it even more plainly, that faith without works is dead? Think about Abraham, who was justified by works when he offered his son Isaac on the altar. Do you see that his faith and works were in unison, and that through his works his faith was made whole? This is why the scriptures say that Abraham believed God, and it was credited to him as righteousness. He was called the friend of God. You see then that a person is justified by works, and not by faith alone. For the early church fathers, works were proof of faith. The Christ follower simply could not lack works. To be a Christian without work was an oxymoron, and it still is. You cannot be a bodybuilder without lifting weights. You cannot be a musician without ever playing an instrument. You cannot be a healthy patient without diet and exercise. And indeed, you cannot be a Christian without works. But you say that you are saved by grace, not by works. That's true. It is also true that there are no checklists in Christianity, no list of things you need to do. And yet, it is also true that faith without works is dead. For the apostles and disciples, works were a given, and they were necessary not because of an external mandate, like a checklist of must-haves to get into heaven, but they were necessary because of an internal mandate, that if you really believe the good news of Jesus, if it's something that you would have swallowed whole and taken to heart, then your own internal motivation compels and your own conscience dictates that you have works to do. It is not sufficient to say you accept Jesus and then do nothing. That is faith without works. That is patient number 2 who makes no lifestyle changes. Now, if you look at yourself, and you know that you have faith that works, like those who will look to Jesus and say, "Lord, Lord," but to whom he will reply, "You say, Lord, Lord, but I never knew you. Depart from me." If that is you, then here are your next steps. First, take time to think about the good news of Jesus. Gnaw on it, chew it over, ponder it again and again, until you really truly start to feel that good news deep down. Mull it over until it migrates from your brain to your heart, and having understood the gospel, you will feel the strong, overwhelming desire to promulgate it out into the world. And what are the works that you do? That's between you and God. Do whatever the Lord places on your heart, but regardless of your specific vocation, share with others the good news that you've embraced. If you would tell everyone in your life about a new job, a new house, the birth of a child, or even a sale at a store you like, then it only makes sense that you also share the best news of your life, that Jesus has redeemed your soul, and that the very God of the universe wants to be near to you. If you believe that, then how can you not share it? Begin there, and the rest will more easily fall into place. Thank you for joining Stories of Symmetry. My name is Ben Laboute, And the mission of this podcast is to reveal beauty and purpose through another look at faith, the sacred, and the stories that unite us all. Be sure to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app, follow at Stories of Symmetry on Facebook and Instagram, and visit storiesofsymmetry.com for blogs, episodes, and more. Don't forget also that my book, Practical Advice for a Better World, is available from wherever you buy books online. And finally, the next episode will be out in 2 weeks. Between now and then, I encourage you to explore works as well as faith. And as you do so, I bid you go with God, go in peace.